one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season, a Philadelphia Phillies podcast. I'm Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus. I'm also the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were doing while Joe DiMaggio was making history, available through major booksellers now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin. Weird. Feels like a start our new series?
Yeah, feels like a quiet start to the Friday that the Phillies have in the off day on Thursday. And the Phillies were doing so well coming into the Cincinnati series, 15-4 in the Don Mattingly era before these three games were played. Liz, word is that the Phillies lost this series, dropping the last two games to the Reds, due to a pair of issues that have always been issues and probably always will be. Your thoughts?
Nothing can be fixed. Everything is forever.
I mean, it's certainly how these problems feel when you're circling back to talk about things like teams not hitting lefties and people named Aaron Nola not making the best start in the world. They also faced some issues that popped out of nowhere. Sure would be a real good time to abruptly lose your best hitter, wouldn't it, Liz? Kyle Schwarber.
That would be real bad, wouldn't it?
Yeah, our big bopper missed all three games against his home state of Ohio after waking up with what Don Mattingly told reporters was, quote, a stomach issue on Monday. He was not available off the bench in the first two games, but according to Lachlan March in the Inquirer, Schwarber was ready to go play on Wednesday and at one point had a helmet in his hand. The Phillies decided down five, they didn't need to shove him out there. Good news is that even after missing three games, Kyle Schwarber, still your Major League Baseball leader in home runs with 20. So no Schwarber, Liz. You turn to the other two members of the Big Three, Harper and Marsh. Well, Bryce Harper was hitless in this series. He did walk and score a run and not get a run in with a sac fly. Marsh had a couple of singles and scored a run. And he and Harper both struck out four times in three games. Well, Phillies didn't score nothing, so where did the offense come from, if not those guys? Well, Alec Bohm, of course. Bohm had two homers and a double, racking up four hits in three games, the highest of any Phillies batter. Trey Turner and Bryson Stott also homered, as did Edmundo Sosa. Turner actually stole three bases throughout this Red series as well, but ultimately it was a loss with the Phillies dropping the last two games, making game three a little more interesting, pulling within a run before the Reds, you know, ran away with it. Liz, in general, your thoughts on this series? I mentioned the two main issues kind of running through it for people, that in game three, Aaron Nola put the Phillies in a hole early, as he is typical to do. And the Phillies offense in general didn't look like it was hitting lefties again after some success in doing so early this month. We'll get into some stats on that I found interesting in a minute here. But yeah, just in general, Phillies offense in this series, not what we've typically seen.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a disappointment. Excuse me, after seeing so much great stuff from them recently, you know, didn't really expect them to drop two of three here, you know, especially with, you know, questionable offense. We'd seen them sort of if not hit the cover off the ball. They've definitely been keeping up. But I think that the Reds might be a little bit better than the Pirates, at least better set up. The Pirates are an illusion. Anyone saying they're good is lying to you. Or lying to themselves. And so I think the Reds are probably a little bit better. And they, you know, they stumbled. It wasn't great. But I think if Kyle Schwarber had been in the lineup, things would look a lot different. Though that in itself is a little concerning. That Kyle Schwarber seems to be the extra ingredient, the final ingredient that gets everything done. And without him, they struggle.
Well, it's easy to see how your lineup is weakened without your Kyle Schwarber in it. The whole reason you get a contract extension for a guy like that is because of the singular level of play that he's capable of bringing. So without him, yeah, that's already you're at a disadvantage. I will say in game one, the Phillies, their one win from this series, they came back to take a 5-4 win over the Reds thanks to a couple of home runs. Alec Boehm had a home run in that game. Bryson Stott had a home run in that game to give the Phillies the lead. But I think the most encouraging thing from that start, if you want to look back on a series loss for encouraging moments, would be Andrew Painter's six innings of work. He allowed only 3 hits, 2 earned runs, 2 walks, and 3 strikeouts. You know, wasn't the best start of the day. He's not going to win NL Player of the Week. We're not in Christopher Sanchez territory here, but in general I think it's one of his better starts so far, and encouraging progress to see from a pitcher in his position. I mean, a young guy like that having the kind of season he's had, up and down, comes out and, you know, puts six innings of work in and gives the offense a chance to come back, which they do. I mean, this is in general I think what people are looking for from Andrew Painter right now. Liz, is that fair to say?
I mean, I certainly was happy with what I saw. And if you're looking for more from Painter, you're looking for a different pitcher. Because this is exactly what he should be doing as a fifth starter. He went out. He did well. He doesn't eat innings. That's not who he is. But he was able to keep the Phillies in it. It wasn't necessarily their fault. It wasn't necessarily his fault that they couldn't, you know, ultimately win. So I was really thrilled to see that from him, especially after some of his more recent starts.
Well, there were a couple of X factors that popped up and made this series a little extra spicy for the Phillies. However, you can't really talk about it too much and ignore the two elements I mentioned earlier, both the Phillies facing lefties and Aaron Nola. And we're going to talk a little bit about both those things here. The Phillies faced a lefty in 58 plate appearances during this series, Liz. You know, even facing the Guardians coming up this weekend, you're getting another series where they're getting two righties and a lefty. And, you know, you got to be able to take advantage of that, because as the season, as you know, later we get into the season, certainly in the second half, certainly in the home stretch, and certainly, obviously, in the playoffs, the wide berth teams give you when they know you can't hit a specific type of pitcher starts narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. And you gotta really take advantage of the fact that you're facing a lot of righties now, where teams don't have to be as strategic about that. It's more about spreading out the workload. You got to take advantage of facing the righties you're facing now, and because this team runs into that wall of lefties all too often. Their strikeout and walk rates were exactly the same throughout this series, 13.8% for both of them. That they're in 58 plate appearances, they were good enough for a 200 batting average. They had 9 hits in 58 plate appearances against lefties in this series. Now here's the interesting part. Against the Marlins, the A's, and the Rockies at the beginning of this month, whom the Phillies played from May 1st to May 10th, the Phillies faced lefties in 76 plate appearances combined against those three teams. And in that time, they hit .389 against lefties with 9 extra base hits and 5 home runs. They had an off day on May 11th. Since that off day, they have played against the Red Sox, Pirates, and Reds, in which they faced lefties in 113 plate appearances, so they had greater exposure to lefties, and they combined to hit .215 against them. Same amount of extra base hits, comically enough, with 9, and actually more home runs with 6. But they did not hit nearly as often as they were at the beginning of the month. So, Liz, what conclusions can we draw from this information? The Phillies hit home runs against lefties even when they're not really hitting them well. Is that a too positive spin on this? Perhaps, but this data does indicate that it might be the case. The last hits the Phillies will get off a lefty, even when they're starting to not hit them, is a home run. I don't think that's totally out of line, because that's kind of what this lineup is built to do. It's just when they're not hitting a lot, that, you know, home run every 12 to 15 to 20 at-bats isn't really going to be super helpful. That said, they were hitting lefties earlier this month very well, and now they're not. The Marlins, A's, and Rockies, yes, they're not a murderer's row of opponents. Their bullpens from May 1st to May 10th featured 3 of the 6 highest left-handed pitching ERAs in baseball, with the A's having the highest at 732. So just in that span alone, their lefties weren't putting up the best numbers, even when they weren't playing the Phillies. And that's without looking at the whole season stats, which tell us that those three pitching staffs, the Marlins, A's, and Rockies, have 3 of the top 7 highest left-handed pitching ERAs in all of baseball so far this season. So even if you widen it from such a small sample size, you see the same three teams near the top. And they happen to be the teams the Phillies played during that run in which they were actually hitting left-handed pitchers. So the Phillies were facing teams with already bad left-handed pitching doing some of its worst work, which may have been a factor as to why they were hitting lefties so well to start the month of May. Now, that said, even a bad lefty, we've seen it, even a bad lefty can beat the Phillies. And that didn't happen earlier this month when they were hitting .389 against them in 76 plate appearances. In Cincinnati, it was a little more visible. And against the Red Sox and Pirates, I'd say as well. So, Liz, would you call this progress for the Phillies? That, you know, okay, they were at least hitting some lefties, even if they weren't very impressive lefties. Or is this now just a more of a flare-up of a permanent problem that this team can't hit lefties and this is its more normal state here?
Well, you can't say that they can't hit lefties because we've seen them do it. We can hope that this is just part of a cycle. Right, we can hope this is just part of a natural cycle that they'll go through. You know, they're facing some tougher opponents. They've got to step it up. This is where they have to sort of show that they deserve the comeback that they've given themselves, or at least that they deserve to continue to make the comeback now that they're sort of back at even. So I will hope that it's part of a cycle and not just the result of playing much more difficult teams. But this weekend will really be a test of that.
I don't want to get doomer about it, but this is one of those deeper seated issues that you're like, okay, even if they do find a way to win, despite having this flaw of being a poor lefty hitting team, you do run into, like I said, teams are going to get more strategic. You're going to have more lefties thrown at you. And then obviously in the playoffs, the matchups are have way more weight to them and teams are using them to pretty much write their game plans. You're going to run into a wall of lefties at some point. So it does kind of bring up the notion of like, well, what's the point of any of this? If you know eventually you're going to have to face the kind of pitcher that you struggle so much against. But also at this point, I feel like you can't sit there and say, well, this team has to get better at that, because they've had years to get better at that. And it hasn't really significantly improved to the point that you stop saying it's a problem that they have. This year, they're hitting .230. That's incorrect. It has continued to be a problem for this team, whether it's, you know, blipped up a little bit or been particularly bad for a couple of weeks. This year, they're hitting .217. In the 2026 regular season against left-handed pitchers. Like, again, this is not a lot of teams have splits in this regard, but this is kind of dramatic. And like I said, eventually you're just going to start facing more of the kind of pitching you can't hit. And the only real solution is to have there be less pitching that you can't hit. And I don't know if you can see this team really like working this out of its system. That being said, I'm still going to find the first 10 days of this month really encouraging. Because that was a high spike, even if it was against some of the lousier left-handed pitching, they were able to do it, which you've seen so many examples of pitchers who have no business dominating a lineup, dominating the Phillies, and, you know, this at least gives them something to pull from. Like, all right, this was a time we were successful against lefties. Let's just use that as a starting point moving forward, or, you know, do what we're actually going to do. Just kind of close our eyes and think, all right, well, maybe it'll all just work out, even though this problem is still here, as will be the case with the next problem we're about to discuss. But yeah, Liz, any final thoughts on the Phillies and lefties, how this situation can improve, or how has it improved?
I mean, it's going to sound so dumb. It improved because they just hit lefties. I mean, it improved because they did better, and I wish we knew how that happened beyond, hey, they're playing crappy teams. Because it would be great if they could capture that in a bottle and open it whenever they needed it, because they're going to need it against the Guardians this weekend.
Well, then there was the other forever problem standing on the mound. Didn't see the typical Aaron Nola problems on Wednesday. Yes, he allowed 4 earned runs on 77 pitches through 5 innings. No walks or home runs surrendered. So, different kind of Aaron Nola disaster. But it's tough to look at Nola's season as anything other than characteristically frustrating. Charlotte Varnes and Matt Gelb had a piece in The Athletic talking to JT Realmuto and Aaron Nola and about, you know, getting older and like becoming veterans on the team and the struggles that they've both gone through, Real Muto at the plate. It's tough to see anybody struggle, especially somebody like Nola, Real Muto said. He works so hard. He's such a good competitor. He's gotten a lot of big outs for this team. We wouldn't be where we're at without him. So we're all pulling for him to get through it. We have confidence that he will. Now, I mean, you know, that's a nice quote you're going to see from a catcher about his pitcher, one of the Phillies' big-time, you know, pitchers, I guess you still call him. But when he says, like, we're all pulling for him to get through it, you're wondering, like, I wonder if he means, like, recently or how far back he's referring to it when he says that. But that's probably putting too much weight on the words of a catcher who's just trying to put some positive stuff out there about a guy he knows is struggling. Real Muto talked about Nola looking good, then leaving pitches over the plate and falling behind in counts. And you're like, yep. But, like, we say these things. They're just bad pitching. Like, it's just bad fundamental pitching. Like, mistakes are being made. The ball's doing things you're not telling it to do. It's just, it feels like it goes through this Aaron Nola filter first, where you're like, well, it's not supposed to be like this. But, I mean, he's just such an indefinable pitcher that you're just like, all right, I guess this is something he could potentially get through. He's got 4.5 more years here, so somebody's got to figure something out because they're hitting 312 against him with men on base this year, and only slightly worse than that with the bases empty. Nola says it's all about getting the leadoff guy out and, quote, trying to keep runners off the base paths and limit the damage. If you've ever watched an Aaron Nola post-game press conference, you've heard him say something like that countless times, but if you look at Nola's fastball, the main pitch of any pitcher's arsenal, you can find metrics that point to it currently as the worst pitch in Major League Baseball. And that same graph also said Christopher Sanchez's changeup is the best pitch in all of baseball. So the Phillies have both. If you're ever struggling to define them. Yeah. Can't do it halfway. Got to do it the worst or best.
Never.
That's how we do things around here. So what is the answer here? Because once more, the Phillies find themselves in a spot in which there has to be an answer. According to Varnes and Gelb's article, Mattingly said they've tried a couple of things with Nola, pitching backwards, using his fastball more, using more changeup, using a more breaking ball. Liz, do you think running down a list of solutions like this will lead to them finding something that works for Nola? When they find something that does work, won't it? I mean, it's just going to stop working eventually. This is, you know, he's a guy that at this point, there's always a, you know, there's always a new leak springing, it feels like, with Aaron Nola. Is his ceiling now like one okay start between five or six rougher ones? Like, is that generally where we're at with Nola? Because I got to tell you, I got very little satisfaction from finally seeing someone sort of lay out like, all right, so like this is what he's doing. And this is what we're trying to do to fix that. You're like, none of this sounds like it's, I feel like he's going to require more than that because the grind just isn't working out what's troubled him.
Yeah, like suggesting things that are wrong is great, and I hope they find it. But why haven't they found it yet? Like, and has it been changing and morphing? Does he have a ghost inside of him that's making it more difficult? I don't know. But I mean, it didn't comfort me much either to hear like, well, it's not this. We've tried this, and like, well, then what is it? Like, yes, they're professionals, but even this type of thing is above professionals. It's weird, like, body-brain stuff. But you would think that they could figure something out by now. Like, what are they not doing? Like, they're trying all of this and this, and, like, have we recognized the fact first that Aaron Nola is now a significantly different pitcher than he was in his early days when he was putting together his, you know, his little roster of pitches? Things are a lot different now. And I just don't know if what they're doing now is going to cut it. Just like what you said, they're going to have to do more. You know, I don't know.
I mean, and like, what is that? You're just kind of surviving. Yeah. The scariest Aaron Nola stat right now is the 4.5 years left on his contract that you're just like, yeah. We signed up for this. And I would say the lion's share of fans and writers were for them giving Nola an extension. Like, even at that point, the length at which this kind of output has been going on wasn't as long because it was, you know, a few years ago. And additionally, he probably had more people thinking he could bounce back to his higher ceiling from earlier in his career at that point as well. The market wasn't looking very promising. And I think at the time you were generally looking at him like, yeah, he's had his struggles, but he's still viewed as like the number two. At the very least, I think the evolution of Aaron Nola being like a back of the rotation guy has been accepted only recently, I would say, like starting last year. And I think even the people who had a problem with the extension, if they had voiced concerns about it, it would have been just voicing concerns while ultimately understanding that it was the thing the Phillies had to do, or didn't have like a solution to replace it if they said the Phillies should flat out not do it. Like, it was a thing that was accepted as the Phillies should do this. They kind of have to, and they also should. And now here we are in this position, which I think a lot of the even people who supported it would have said, yeah, this is kind of what I was afraid of, that there'd still be sparks flying out of him and it would still be a couple years in with a couple more to go. And he's kind of playing an important role on a team that's built around its starting pitching. So at this point, you're just trying to like survive an Aaron Nola start and feel fortunate that, again, it's the regular season. So he's part of shouldering this pitching load. For guys who have been more effective than him at this point, he can, you know, at least do that. He can at least eat 5-6 innings for you every couple of days. But I don't know. I have so much confusion about Aaron Nola that moving forward, I'm not going to say this is much different from how I've approached it for a while. But you know, this is just what kind of what it looks like. And this glimpse behind the curtain, as brief as it was and simple as it was, it doesn't do much for you. You're like, yeah, it sounds like everyone's doing what they're supposed to do in this situation. The situation has just gone on for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see how that develops, though. Like I said, I don't super expect it to. But that being said, like you mentioned, the Phillies do have a bit of a handful this weekend as the Cleveland Guardians come to town. The Cleveland Guardians, who just finished a 4-game sweep of the Detroit Tigers, Liz. And there was a piece in The Athletic about how, yeah, Guardians are sitting up in first place right now in the AL Central. And it's viewed as a bit of a surprise, actually. I think a lot of people had the Tigers up there. Tigers are without Tarek Skubal and have just been not looking great lately. They are in last place in the AL Central, actually. Royals never came out firing, despite the Bobby Witt Jr. of it all. Twins, you know, ripped their own guts out last season, not really considered much of a threat. And the White Sox are being viewed, I think Murataki Murakama's success has really put them on the map, and they've also just played better. They're a game over 500 right now. They're viewed as something of a Cinderella story, but not potentially a playoff team yet. So it's kind of Cleveland running the show in the AL Central. And get this, Liz, with one of the league's, if not the league's smallest payroll, they are still winning. So it's time for everyone's favorite feature article. How are these guys doing it? Because, you know, they're just... it's the curse of every quote-unquote small market, which means small payroll team, excelling, Liz. It's what's got to be said. You know, they're doing it. They're making so there's so little money involved here, and isn't it sort of Liz making these big money teams like the Phillies and the Mets and the Yankees? Isn't it really sticking it to them, Liz? Like, look, don't you feel silly spending all this money when the Guardians have proven that having a real stud pitcher come out of their farm system every other year is a more effective strategy? It sounds like I'm being sarcastic, but I am extremely envious of the endless geyser of strong pitching that comes out of Cleveland's system and allows them to operate without having to spend a ton of money in free agency, which is a good thing. It is also not always a good thing. The Guardians have just been able to go about this thing, Liz, a different way. An insufferableness of their coverage aside, manager Stephen Vogt will read you any quote you want about how people come to the Guardians to win and they just want to win and winning is great and blah, blah, blah. But a layer down, one layer down is where the answers about the AL Central leading $70 million Guardians team is, care of Zach Meisel and Cody Stavenhagen in The Athletic, who write, "For years, the Guardians' backbone has been pitching with a vaunted factory that churns out one capable starter after another and allows the front office to ignore exorbitant free agent prices or farm system snapping trades. They walk a ton. They run a lot. They drive in all of the traffic sometimes. A league average attack might not sound like much, but it's dramatically superior to the 29th ranked offense the club somehow carried into October last season. So here the Guardians are, Liz, hot off this four-game sweep of the Tigers, keeping it together with an offense that's not power-based, more on getting on base and knocking guys in, all with a strong pitching staff to lean on. I mean, you can see where they overlap with the Phillies. You can also see where they're totally different. Are the Phillies catching this team at exactly the wrong time? You know, coming off their first series loss in six series, and the Guardians feeling hot, just taking out the Tigers?
Let's reflect. You said the Tigers are in last place?
Yep.
Okay. That feels very similar to the Phillies beating the crap out of a bunch of real bad teams recently. Like, yeah, they four-game sweep is not nothing, but it's also against the Tigers. So, I mean, I think they're a good team. I think all of the fanfare about them is hilarious because it happens every year. Just like when the Pirates do well every year, everyone's like, is this the time? Is this the moment that the Pirates finally come alive? Every time the Guardians do well or are doing well at some, you know, watershed point in the season, everyone's like, oh, let's find out how they do well. Let's see what they do. And like, it's not really that hard. You could see what they do on the field. They're dedicated to the way that they play baseball. And they don't just draft well, they sign well. I don't even think their drafting has been that impressive. They have a really good international scouting department that's been able to help them. You know, they just know who the type of guy they're looking for. They know how he's going to fit in their system, and that's how they do things. They found not just a weakness in the market, they found a strength of themselves, and it's upon that that they've built their entire system. And you could make, there is nothing you can do in baseball that's always going to work except having more money than anybody. So this will eventually break down. But for now, like, it's making them a team that's hard to beat in the, I will say it, relatively weak American League Central. We talk about this every year. American League Central has never been a powerhouse of, at least in the more recent times. Like, none of them are considered to be, like, powerhouse hitting teams. It all seems to be, they're all like the Royals, they're sort of like wily and, you know, run prone. And I forgot where I was going with this, but I was making a really good point.
Yeah, I could feel it. You're not wrong, but I will say Jose Ramirez of the Guardians is always a player who gets overlooked.
Actually going to mention that, like, he's like the most underrated player in baseball for the last like 10 years. He's exceptional, and no one pays attention to him because he's over in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to go with Cleveland.
Yeah, he's a third baseman. He's one of those bigger, he's like a bigger hitter third baseman, and he's 33 years old. But he excels in Cleveland. He's the one who took, I think, he gave them like a hometown discount and was like, I want to stay here. Like, this is where I want to be. Like, this is the organization that they've treated me well. I love the city and I love the people. And he, you know, he used to kind of, I think, see that a little more often. And that's not me like finger wagging at anything. It was just historically, I feel like you did occasionally see players do that. You really don't see that, like, that statement get made a whole lot anymore. But to see a player do that now and be like, yeah, I want to stay with one team. I know there's people who enjoy the purity of that. And it does feel very old school to just have a player be like, yeah, this is I'm really good and this is where I want to be. And the fans are like, great. And the team's like, great. And everything just lines up and they all get their guy. Unfortunately, you know, like I said, not spending can be what we pat the Guardians on the back about now as they sit atop, again, another soft underbelly of the American League in the Central Division, where even the teams that were projected to be good aren't as good this year. The Tigers aren't just in last place. They're 9.5 games behind the Guardians right now after a four-game sweep. So the Guardians just really threw some dirt on them down there in the hole. That being said, you know, spending in a couple more areas and beefing up this lineup would make you, yeah, you maybe don't need to do that to win the AL Central, but you probably do need to do that to compete on the larger stage in the postseason. So we'll see. We'll see how being the small market scrappers works out for Cleveland this year. If it finally gets them, you know, through the final round, or if it is the millionth time in a row they fall just short. But regardless, I do think they're going to be a handful coming into Philadelphia this weekend. They were pretty handedly beating the Tigers over the past 4 days. So I think you're catching a lineup that is effective. Yes, gets on base and is very annoying in that regard. I'm really glad that they will not be facing Aaron Nola. This feels like the kind of team that could just eat Aaron Nola's lunch and drive him kind of insane. And they are going to get Christopher Sanchez and Zach Wheeler in games one and two. So that also makes me feel pretty good because those guys are back, I think, into stopper status for the Phillies. And then you get Andrew Painter in the Sunday matinee at 1:35 as well. So, you know, hopefully he can build off some success there. But really, the main return that I think we need to talk about as the Cleveland Guardians come to town, Liz, is that they're bringing an old buddy of ours with them in Rhys Hoskins coming back to take on the Phillies at Citizens Bank Park this weekend.
Oh, I'm so happy.
The Inquirer ran a whole feature on Hoskins a bit, or at least a section on with the fateful moment when Rhys Hoskins suffered a season-ending non-contact injury just before his last regular season in Philadelphia was about to begin. Right before the role of right-handed cleanup hitter became an ongoing and unsolvable problem in Philadelphia, Hoskins, the story reads, a guest on the Inquirer's Phillies Extra podcast this week, said he wished the Phillies would have asked Harper to move to the outfield after the 2023 season, though he's also a, quote, firm believer that everything in life happens for some sort of reason, whether you like it or not. And, I mean, I remember, you know, Harper's kind of said the same thing. I remember him, the quote being like, I would move back to the outfield for the right first baseman. But I remember that being in the context of Pete Alonso being signed here, potentially, even
something
though the
like
Phillies
that.
Were the Phillies were never close on that. I always got the impression he just, I don't know, considered Reese not the best first baseman. But that can't, no, I did not always think that. I actually always got the sense of the opposite, that Harper and Hoskins were good teammates. And yeah, they've only,
they've kind of love each other.
They seem to indicate, yeah, like they understood each other's roles, and Hoskins definitely understood his role. And I don't know. I don't know if he then shared what reason that was when Hoskins said this happened for a reason as well. But I mean, looking back, we've done a couple of what if episodes on Hittin' Season. I know one of our favorites is what if the Phillies hired Mike Arbuckle instead of Ruben Amaro as GM. You know, you can go back in history. I've tried to write down a few for the next time we do it, so we have some fresh ones. But I think a new one is going to be what if Rhys Hoskins doesn't get hurt in his last season in Philadelphia. I mean, that's essentially what this article was asking. Does that moment live in your head as well? You were a big Rhys Hoskins fan.
Oh, constantly I think about it. Like, I think about Rhys Hoskins all the time. Whenever someone hits a home run, like, they've stopped sort of sending love to the bullpen, which was, you know, Hoskins' thing. And I know Harper did it for a few years after. I miss that type of thing. And I really would love it if they would invite him back, you know, just to, whenever Hoskins is ready to do that, invite him back just to be a bench guy, be a, you know, a different type of Garrett Stubbs. You know, he's talented. He can hit home runs. And I think that's valuable. And at some point, the Phillies will need a guy like that. I think when I think about Rhys Hoskins' future in Philadelphia, I always know. I know that he'll be on the Wall of Fame the moment he's eligible. There's like no question. It doesn't matter how short of a time, quote unquote, he was here. He was here for a number of really important Phillies moments and moments he himself caused. I just want him to come home. Come home, Rhys.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who feels like he would have a role with the Phillies after his career, but it almost feels way because it almost feels like he was here. I don't know. He was here a while. It just feels like there's a missing title from his time. Like, people might forget he was not here for a title. He just, because the team was so set up for that. And it's just like that element you miss when a team is in a golden era but doesn't win a World Series or hasn't won a World Series yet. And it doesn't feel like it has a flag to like stake the whole era to, and Hoskins' legacy is kind of like a part of that. I'm not saying anything. I think you're exactly right. He's a Wall of Famer. He's going to be a lot of people's fan favorites. That home run against the Braves is still my favorite Phillies home run ever. It is the most satisfying thing I've ever seen in that stadium. It was so amazing. He was an interesting player because he came up and he honestly felt like he had a Major League Baseball superstar's comfort and like affability and community. communication skills. He just didn't really have that output. Like, we all know what his strengths were. He could hit 8 home runs in 5 days, and then he wouldn't hit one for 2 weeks, and then he'd hit another 10 for you in 5 days or whatever. Like, he would have these spasms of power where that's what he would do. And he would fill the role of that cleanup hitter that we're talking about pretty well. That's just the kind of player he was. But he just, yeah, as far as like communication and team leadership, it felt like he had that mentality of like a superstar. So that was always really interesting to me to see how vocal he was willing to be and how defensive of his teammates he was always willing to be. Yeah, it just feels like he's just missing that title. And they're still missing it. And I don't know, that hopefully that doesn't come to define this era, but that's ultimately what all of these what ifs come down to, is whether or not they won the World Series. And it feels weird. It feels like Rhys Hoskins, it feels like not that he wasn't here when they won one. It just feels like there's one missing.
Yeah, it does. You know, yeah. That injury was just so devastating for all of us, because we all kind of knew that he wasn't coming back no matter what we said. Yeah. At least I continued to lie to myself for quite a while. But, I mean, we all knew he wasn't coming back, and it would have been great to have been able to enjoy that last season, you know, as a tribute to his time in Philadelphia, to how much the fans loved him, to how much he meant to the team in 22. Because I've always thought that his departure sort of made the Phillies worse chemistry-wise. He was just a guy that was able, at least in my mind, a guy who's able to communicate well with every sort of niche of the Phillies. There's like the Harper, you know, Real Muto niche. There's like Schwarber over there, who's also being like, him and Schwarber have a lot in common, I think. They're just like slightly different versions of each other.
Yeah, and I think Gene Segura's departure from that team as well. I think those were two subtractions at the very least from the culture they'd built. And yeah, sure, mm-hmm. The moments like that, times like that, changes like that certainly can make a difference in any roster. So
chemistry, yeah, matters.
Just an ultimately, I think he'll be getting a round of applause every time he comes back to Philadelphia, Rhys Hoskins. Yeah, I think all you can look back on is a missed opportunity and a really unfortunate injury for Hoskins. But speaking of the past, we go back even further. The Phillies announced this week on July 12th, part of Philadelphia's MLB All-Star Game hosting duties will be to put on the All-Star 3-on-3s. You familiar with this?
No.
This is a modified home run derby in which players earn points for homers and defensive plays, with bonus points available on target hits and on the hot streak. Each player will have 1 2-minute at-bat during a 3-inning game, while the opposing team will set up their 3 players in the outfield. Teams earn a point for each home run and a point for each catch. Bonus points can be earned by hitting balls through a center field target placed above the outfield fence, or calling for a hot streak of 5 swings where offensive and defensive points count double. At the end of a game, the team with the most points wins. It's okay if you didn't follow that. It's probably not something, it was something that I would be like, wow, that's cool, and then not watch. But it's in Philadelphia, and the reason we're talking about it is because it was announced that 3 of the teams will be captained by Ryan Howard, Jimmy Rollins, and Shane Victorino. There will also be a fourth team of rivals. None of them were announced yet. And as cool as it all is to see old friends, Liz, Phillies fans naturally noticed more who was not on that list. The man, or perhaps as he is known in his new home in London, the bloke, Chase Utley, not a team captain for this event. Liz, why does Chase Utley not like us in Philadelphia? Is it because we're weird and off-putting and ask questions like that?
No, I'm sure he's quite used to that. I think he's, I don't know, he doesn't seem like much of an on-field guy anymore. You know what I mean? going to England, doing all of that, it feels like he's definitely more of a corporate MLB guy now. Which is fine. Listen, I'm not.
Jace Utley's showing up for band practice in a suit. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I'm thinking. I just don't know if you know, this fun on field stuff is who he is anymore. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not. I'm not saying it's because he's a bad person. Or he hates baseball and thinks it's all stupid. But it's just, you know, a guy changing. He was always a pretty reserved guy, all things considered.
Of course. And I'm just joking as well that Chase Utley, you know, it's always just funny more the reaction when people see this era at the center of something. It's like, and where's Chase? We did this the entire, speaking of the 2022 World Series when, like, you know, they made it all the way, they won the pennant. And so, like, celebrities started showing up at the ballpark for every game. And they would just, the one night there were some kids dancing on the dugout and they were like, oh, and those are like, these are the kids who were dancing. And they read their names and they all had Phillies players' last names. And they said one of the kids was an Utley. And people were like, oh, there had been no Chase sighting yet. And everyone was like, where is he? Where is he? And they finally showed him on the Jumbotron. People went nuts. He will always be, he makes the people want it. He will always be the one that if he's not on the list, people will say, where is he? It'll just always be the case.
He knows how to do it. The man knows how to leave him wanting. He doesn't abuse the effect that he has on Philadelphia because he knows it's very potent.
But he is aware of it. Yes.
He is, of course. He has to.
Yeah, it'd be silly.
And if he wasn't aware of it, the Phillies have now told him.
Well,
the Phillies themselves have done, because they certainly notice it and they want to make sure that they milk it for all it's worth. And I love it. I want them to do that. Give us stage.
And he's done multiple bits with Rob McElhenney about it. So I think he gets the vibe as well.
He does. He definitely gets the vibe. He's a good time guy.
Does it disturb you any further, Liz, if I read you an even longer list of names on which Chase Utley is not? And this is over the 40 players who will be appearing in the All-Star Village over the weekend. Bobby Abreu, Larry Boa, Steve Carlton, Dave Cash, Andre Dawson, John Denny, Lisa Fernandez, Rolly Fingers, Minnie Forbes, Tom Gordon, Cole Hamels, Jay Happ, Vaughn Hayes, Ryan Howard, Fergie Jenkins, Jim Catt, John Kruk, Mike Lieberthal, Greg Luzinski, Charlie Manuel, Gary Matthews, Mickey Morandini, Jamie Moyer, Dale Murphy, Dickie Knowles, Roy Oswalt, Lance Parrish, Placido Polanco, Ron Reed, Jimmy Rollins, Carlos Ruiz, Juan Samuel, Gene Segura, Pedro Sierra, Milt Thompson, Manny Trio, and Randy Wolf.
The Phillies are holding him back for something. You know it now.
You're getting at least a video message, I feel, at some kind of moment, sorry. You know.
No. There is nowhere else on earth that Chase Utley should be at that weekend. It is the only All-Star game Philadelphia is going to have for the next 30 years, at least. And so he should be, there's no video message. Are you insane? The city would riot if he wasn't there. I'm going to guess they're holding him back because they don't want, their ticket sales are already insane. I think they just don't want it. Maybe they don't want to influence it, or they're just holding him back for like a massive surprise or something. Chase Utley will be lowered down from the sky on, you know, in a parachute.
Chase Utley will be fired from the hot dog cannon on the field into one lucky fan seat. We'll be seeing how that
one
situation
lucky
develops.
Fan will be killed by Chase Utley. Get in line.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. Like I said, this weekend, Phillies get the Guardians at Citizens Bank Park on Friday. Tonight at 6:40, you get first pitch between Gavin Williams and Christopher Sanchez there at Citizens Bank Park. Saturday's first pitch will be at 4:05 with Slade Ciccone versus Zach Wheeler. And then on Sunday at 1:35, you get Parker Misek versus Andrew Painter. That'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week from anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittinseason. I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.